Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotech Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle.
www.serotalk.com,
a production of Serotech Corporation, makers of System Access, the System Access Mobile Network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Jamie Pauls.
Welcome to Serotalk Podcast 93 for January 23rd, 2012. I'm Jamie Pauls.
I'm Ricky Anger.
Look out, it's Joe Steinkamp.
Back from his cruise. How was that, by the way?
Oh, dude, it's like a Golden Corral on the water. It is food everywhere, lots of people playing bridge and bingo and slots in international waters. But no, I was on the Carnival Magic, which is like the size of 3 football fields, a little longer than that. And my room was in the very front and all the good stuff was in the back. So I got a lot of walking in.
Yeah.
Go eat 4 pounds of food and then walk it off.
Well, somebody asked me if the cruise was accessible. And I was like, I was able to get to the food. Yes. No, but there isn't a lot of Braille on that ship. And I'm not sure. I've talked to Buddy Brandon, who's done a cruise. And, you know, you have to set up things for a guide ahead of time. So as long as you do that, I could see how that might be worth it. But I don't know if I would do a cruise solo. I have to say Carnival staff was super helpful, though. Every time my wife left me to go do something else and I was there with my cane, I got approached almost immediately about, you know, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? There's a table to your left, sir. So, you know, it was really good. I enjoyed the time away. One of the cool things was watching Iron Man up on the top deck. And to be in the middle of, like, the Atlantic Ocean watching a movie while the wind is blowing and nobody around you is kind of freaky, but still kind of cool. Yeah.
Okay, so what would have happened had your wife stepped away during the middle of Iron Man? I feel like it would get annoying at times for staff to come up. Are you aware you're watching a movie, sir? Can I get you anything?
If you're involved in an activity, I wasn't approached. So if I was sleeping or watching or, you know, being in a trivia contest or something like that, that was fine.
What if you were just standing at the rail, kind of like, you know, feeling inner peace and enjoying the sea breeze blowing through your hair and suddenly, sir, do you know where you are?
No, but that ship is so large, I could see where that could be helpful, though, you know, because we're talking like, you know, 15 decks and it's gigantic. I mean, literally, it's like a shopping mall. And it's – well, it actually does have malls on it. There's actually deck 5 of that particular ship where you can buy just about anything. But it's – you know, it's something that I think is fun to do. I just don't know if I would do it completely solo. And if you have done it solo, let us know. Give us a iReport through iBlink Radio or write us at resources@serotalk.com. I know some people did on those ACB cruises – where they've done it solo. But why would you want to do something like that solo anyway? But
because that's kind of a social event anyway, right?
Yeah. And there's so many people. I mean, there were 4,200 people on this boat plus 1,050 staff.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a gigantic city. And what is really cool, though, is they did have a channel that would read you what all the events were. They called it the Audio Fun Time. So it was somebody who came on and then read whatever, because at night they come down and turn down your bed and put down the little flyer of what's going to happen on the ship the next day. But there was
animal towels. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The animal towels were cool. I had a stingray, a monkey that held up on the top, and a dog one day with little towel, hand towels for eyes. They actually, you can buy those books that tell you how to do the towel animals, which is really, really neat. Anyway, that has nothing to do with anything with the assistive technology news. And for those of you who wrote in about my cruise, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And we'll probably talk more when we get to summer vacation. We'll revisit this. But ATIA is coming up next week. Just back in time for all the coverage that we're going to do. Jamie and I are winging our way out to Orlando next week. And, you know, we've already got some stories coming in pre-convention that we want to cover.
Yes, that's right. We do. And while we're there, while Derek and I are there, we're going to be doing some interviews, and you can listen to those on Samnet Radio and iBlink Radio and catch those. So I'm sure that you will enjoy those. But we're kind of going to give you a little bit of a sneak preview of what's coming. HIMSS is announcing a couple of things A new note taker, for one thing, called the BrailleSense U2. It has a 1 gigahertz mobile CPU, 32 gigabyte flash disk. You can create and read documents in 5 languages, if you happen to be conversant in 5 languages. Use a multi-bilingual dictionary. Some font and style options, IMAP email access. You can encrypt files if you like. Have a full scientific calculator with Nimeth Braille code entry. That's kind of nice. LCD display for sighted teachers or someone else. And something else I thought was quite interesting, a vibrate motor gives alerts for the deafblind. So they're really taking all disabilities into account here with this device.
Yeah, that is cool.
Also, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, 3G USB modem. So a stereo setting with 11 EQ settings. So lots of good stuff. 17 hours of battery life as well.
That's pretty good, actually. There is a discussion, and this discussion was started actually before the release of the HIMSS note taker, and I find it pretty fascinating. If you're a reader of Blind Bargains, and even if you're not, now's a good time to start. They have something, not quite a poll, but more of an article for readers to comment on about the advantages and disadvantages of a note taker or a laptop or phone and Braille display, and they're prompting discussion about which most people prefer and why.
Yeah, you know, this is still a really hot topic. I mean, I've actually been a part of this discussion both informally and formally a couple of different times, and there is a lot of, well, first of all, a lot of very definite, strong opinions on both sides, but a lot of people that just really haven't quite made up their mind and really would like some thoughts from both sides on this issue. So this is really, as I say, still a very hot topic. HIMSS is announcing a new Braille display, the Braille Edge 40 cell Bluetooth compatible display. Works with pretty much any device. And has a 9-key Perkins-style keyboard with 2 4-way navigation keys, 8 function keys, SD storage, and some built-in apps such as an alarm clock, a calculator, stopwatch. There's no pricing yet. We don't know what the pricing on that is going to be.
Humanware is also releasing a new Braille display, or rather an 80-cell version of the latest generation Brailliant. If you use System Access, by the way, the 40-cell version of the latest generation Brailliant is now supported for both reading and Braille input, and we'll be supporting the 80-cell version as well. So Humanware is going to be showing that off this month at ATIA.
And Blio is also making some news. It's now accessible on Android and iOS as well. Is that right, Ricky?
It is, yes. So this is, you know, ironically, it took them a while to get here to actually release a product. But as far as I know, they are the only group to have something accessible on both Android and iOS for reading books.
Speaking of reading, I think we can pretty much say rest in peace cassette tape at this point, because December 2011 marked the last cassette edition of the Braille Monitor. You can still get some books from Bard on cassette if you need them, but they have, I believe, stopped making those as well. If you are a Braille Monitor reader, you can certainly read it on Newsline. It's available as a Word doc, as an MP3 file, print, Braille, and Daisy, which I think is kind of nice for some really good navigation. I found this interesting. If you really want a narrated version by a human narrator, you can actually have that mailed to you on a USB drive, and users are requested to return the drives. I'm going to be interested to see how many people actually take advantage of that particular option.
That's interesting. So they actually have a human come in and narrate each month?
That's my understanding. If I'm reading that correctly, you know, now that you ask me that question, I need to go back and reread the article. I know it mentions narration. Now, whether that is human or whether
narration
that is
or text-to-speech,
right, speech,
yeah.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that one for sure. Perhaps someone can weigh in with that information. That would be a nice email for someone to send to us at resources@serotalk.com and give us an answer to that one, or an iReport, or call the comment line as well. We'll give you that information at the end of the show.
That's right. Let's give a big shout out to Hadley School for the Blind. They have just launched a Blinded Veterans Initiative such that blinded veterans will be able to take advantage of many of the Hadley courses, and they're not going to have to pay anything to be involved in that. And there are quite a few courses to choose from. I think this is quite a nice initiative.
Yes, and our SAM Vets program here at Sarotech is going strong as well, and we are really glad to see that so many
Absolutely.
People are taking.
It's great to look at the SAMNet forums, both the users forum and other forums dealing with various other topics, and to see all of these new names and faces. And we're welcoming quite a few vets, so glad you guys could join us. If you would like more information about the SAMNet Vets program, check it out at sarotech.com/SAMNetVets.
For those of you who are regular listeners to our podcast, you'll remember that in Podcast 90 back in December, we had some interviews, and then our own Lisa Salinger did a review of Microsoft Security Essentials. And in that review, she mentioned that System Access reported buttons in the program, which really should have been tabs. Well, that has now been fixed. So when you're using System Access, you now hear the correct information as you arrow around and tab around in Security Essentials. In more news related to Sarotech, our own System Access Mobile Network took part in a protest against SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, and the Protect IP Act that's in the Senate. This is something that's of great concern to many people because of the possible government intervention in shutting down websites, being really heavy-handed and some real concerns there. And so one of the things, many websites went completely dark, just completely went offline. But many others also just put some messages up on their website letting people know that they needed to contact their representatives with concerns. And System Access had a message and a short little form that allowed a person to contact their local representatives in their area. And basically what you did was you fill out a form with your name, zip code, that sort of thing, and phone number. And then you would receive a call, and you could basically call your representative. It worked really well. I actually did it. It was quite easy to use. And I'm glad to see that we participated in being able to voice our concerns that way.
And because so many people voiced their concerns, SOPA at this point is not moving through. Now, it's an interesting discussion and one that we can't spend as much time as we might like on. But the real issue, I think, is that Congress is not very well educated about how the internet works and, you know, how various technology works. And there are people who say, oh, if you're against the Stop Online Piracy Act, then clearly you enjoy piracy and you want to steal things. And that's not true at all. I think the protests against this had to do more with how the government intended to implement this rather than we don't want to stop online piracy. And so many of the lawmakers who backed out of SOPA, and so it's not going through now, they did so because they recognized the need for more education before they passed a law like this.
The Daily Show was really funny. They actually had some of the Senate and Congress hearings. The head of the intellectual property person that looks over that commission gets up and admits, I'm just a country boy and I really don't understand exactly how this works. And you're like, wait a minute.
But let's go pass it.
You're the head of IP. How are you not? And then they cut to like four or five different people on the panel who goes, the only people who understand this are the nerds. So let's get some nerds in here and they can explain it. And literally it's just clip after clip of them going, let's get the nerds in here. And Jon Stewart goes, when did this become an episode where Ogre from Revenge of the Nerds comes in, you know, nerds. You know? It was like, that's what it got reduced to because Congress, you know, we're back to that series of tubes and trucks and wires and all of that. And that's the scary part is that people who are entrusted with making policy are wanting to change things or alter things on the basic way that the internet works in ways that they don't understand or can understand the ramifications of. And so that's really kind of it. Tech News Today and some of the other resources that we've published in other Sarah Talk podcasts are great places if you want to learn more about this. It's not completely going away. Of course, like something like this, it shows up in another form or they rename it. So it was very, very informative to a lot of people. What was really funny for our support staff was those who aren't following this were not aware that there were so many sites that were doing blackouts. So we got calls about websites being down or broken or things like that. And it was, you know, if you're not in kind of the tech news loop, you might not have realized that Wikipedia or other sites were going down in protest. So we had a lot of fun conversations with a lot of our customers understanding what this is about. And so there was a good thing to show education, because if things did ever happen, information can't pass as freely and it breaks the internet as we understand it. So some people learned it by accident, and some people took part, like Jamie, in contacting their representative and speaking their voice. But both are good, because information is key.
You know, the internet saw more than its share of disruptions this past week. Zappos.com was hacked. 24 million customers were affected, and customers were asked to reset their passwords. Some names, email addresses, shipping addresses, phone numbers, and the last four digits of their credit card numbers, and some encrypted passwords were hacked. And so the site actually temporarily turned off all of its phone support.
Yeah, they did.
They said that, 5% of their customer base would be about 1 million phone calls. And so they decided they had probably better not try to handle that load. So 12 years of trust was, you know, damaged. I'm sure that they will survive, but that was probably a pretty tough week for them. It's not the largest attack, by the way. Sony's PlayStation Network has 70 million customers. And this morning, just before we came to record this podcast, I saw on the news that the hacker group Anonymous took down the Justice Department's website in retaliation for something that they were angry about as well. So this is a serious problem.
It's becoming more and more commonplace in a way, isn't it? It's almost like road construction. Oh, I can't use that today. I'll go around this.
It got hacked.
And the Sony one was crazy, though, because the SPN was down for the Sony PlayStation Network, not us.
Oh.
I realized that after I say that. Wait a minute. The Sony the Sony PlayStation Network is also acronymed as SPN on gaming forums. They were down for 2 months while they retooled and redid everything, and they actually offered privacy protection for a year for people, as part of their We're Sorry package. And that one was really, really tough. So the Zappos thing is bad, but Sony really did have one that was kind of worse. Anonymous, to break this down a little bit, Anonymous is a group of hackers that comes and goes. There's no set number of them. And they decide to go on an agenda and go take down sites or block the commerce of sites in protest. It's kind of like standing in front of a building and blocking the entrance to things. And again, because the word anonymous is used, you can't always say who is a part of this group. So you can't actually go in and say, okay, it's like five guys in Denmark and we should go wipe them off the earth. You know, you never know who's a part of this group. And but they are organized and they do stage protests. And generally, a lot of these protests lately are not necessarily totally malicious, but sometimes they can have accidental things happen where it blocks some people from getting information. So it can be a nuisance. But this is the internet world we live in these days.
You know, we discuss privacy a lot on this podcast, and we will continue to do so. Google is actually testing an authentication scheme via QR codes. We've talked about QR codes in past podcasts as well, how that you might actually be able to have an item and take a picture of a QR code with your phone, and then if you have an app, you might actually be able to gain more information about that the item that you're interested in. And Google is thinking about using this instead of entering a Google account password, such as like if you're on a public computer at a library or something like that, that you can't necessarily trust because it may have keyloggers or something like that on it. Google is experimenting with a phone-based authentication scheme. You would scan a QR code from a special Google web page, and then the QR code would return a web page on the user's phone. So you tap that URL on your phone, and then the desktop browser on the computer that you want to use would redirect to your logged in account without you actually having to type a password on the computer. This isn't quite ready for prime time. And apparently there's even something better coming along. This was kind of one of those rumors that got picked up and leaked. And Google said, yeah, we're working on that, but we're working on some even better stuff as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see what comes down the road related to privacy.
Multi-factor authentication is the term where you have more than one way of entering things in. I mean, we're kind of familiar with that with CAPTCHA and other things. The kind of side comment I have here is that Google also introduced an ice cream sandwich, the new version of Android, the ability to have facial recognition as your password. So your front-facing camera would look at your face and say, oh, yeah, that's Joe. I'm going to open up the phone instead of, you know, typing in a number or sequential number or doing a little drawing on your phone that only you would know. The problem with that was that you could actually hold up a picture of Joe to the camera.
Yep.
And it would let you right on in. So these multi-factor authentications are coming more and more. We'll see that especially as we see more phones being used in commerce or phones being used as your key to your house or your car, because there has to be a way of being able to detect that you is you. And the Security Now podcast over at Twit talks a lot about this. Steve Gibson at GRC talks about something you know, something you have, and something you are. Those are three ways of being able to know that you can have a secure password or have a more secure way of logging into things. It's a really neat science of what security is and how people work. And the really funny thing is that even beyond QR codes and facial recognition, all that, the worst hack in the world is the social hack. So it goes something like this. I call Jamie and I go, hey, Jamie, we're having some problems on the server today. Can I have your password to test it? And Jamie goes, well, of course, it was the IT department. I trust the IT department, you know, no problem, you know. So people have a tendency to offer things socially and drop their guard because they feel that they're in a trusted environment. So even though we've talked about Zappos and Sony and all these other stuff, sometimes the worst thing that we can possibly do is, you know, pass around information freely.
You know, Google, we've talked about them quite a little bit here in the last few minutes. They are one of those companies that people kind of love to hate. You can do a lot with Google, but yet they collect a lot of information, that sort of thing. So there are reasons maybe that some people would like to consider Google free alternatives to doing what they do. And we have an article in our show notes that lists several popular activities that people do and some Google free alternatives. It's kind of interesting because some of these I've never even heard of.
I know. I had never heard of DuckDuckGo, the search engine. I guess I feel a little silly, but I'd never heard of that. And apparently this works really well. One that I had heard of for an alternative to Google Apps is Microsoft Office, say Office 365 or something like that. So I had heard of that one, and they mentioned that this is a great alternative to Google Docs or Google Apps, rather. The alternative to Picasa, the photo collection and photo sharing service from Google, is Flickr. And I actually think that Flickr may be a bit more popular in the mainstream right now anyway than Picasa.
Yeah, you can check all of those out. That's kind of a fun read, an easy article to read. Go over to serotalk.com and check out our show notes. Speaking of web-based applications, Kurzweil Educational Systems is releasing Firefly. It's a universally accessible web-based literacy solution. Now, this works with Kurzweil 3000, as I understand it, you need to own K3000 in order to take advantage of this web-based application. It's based on universal design principles, works in Mac and Windows. And so I'm kind of curious, you know, as to what people think about the need to own the one product before you can use the other.
I sort of wish that they had done these with separate licensing because they're used in separate places. Firefly is something that you might use on the web or in a Word document or wherever you see printed material on your computer, you can use Firefly. And Kurzweil, you open files that have perhaps been scanned in or that you scan yourself and use these things for highlighting and glossary lookup, that sort of thing. I don't know. It just, to me, it makes sense to license them separately.
Yeah, it's like they're taking steps in the right direction, but they're kind of afraid to let go of the past a little bit.
Well, and that concerns me because it being K3000 based, K3000 doesn't necessarily have the same kind of access means that K1000 does. Kurzweil 1000, the version that most blind and low vision people are familiar with, where K3000 is a little bit more towards learning disabled, dyslexia, low vision, and traditionally hasn't been very screen reader friendly. And so that kind of bothers me because if we're starting to see fragmentation within the application system, then there are things that we wouldn't necessarily be able to work with. Now, the fact that they're using universal design is very heartening. That's good. But other parts of the application, if they're not fully accessible to those who are blind and visually impaired, then this might not translate, or you might not even go get that version because that version isn't going to do anything for you.
Yeah, you make a really good point in that most blind people would have K1000 instead of 3000. So even if Firefly were designed perfectly, none of us have seen it yet, but even if it were, what are you going to do? Go buy 3000 that you can't do anything with just to have access to the Firefly features.
Well, speaking of web accessibility or continuing the discussion of web accessibility, it looks like Firefox accessibility is coming to OS 10 on the Mac, and things are kind of moving forward in that direction. There's a blog post in our show notes. There's a new member of the Mozilla accessibility team who has really started some serious work back in November and taken this task on in Firefox accessibility on the Mac. So yeah, there is going to be a call for some brave beta testers. And the blog post that we link to is pretty specific about the fact that there are going to be some issues. This is not going to be for the faint of heart. But if you're serious about wanting to test this in a week or so, there should be more information about how to go about that.
We also get a lot of calls and questions and letters in about Firefox accessibility on the Windows side. Version 10, which is in beta now, should be coming out in the next couple of months. Or with Firefox, we could go to bed and wake up tomorrow and it'll be here, because sometimes that happens that three versions show up overnight. The new version of Firefox is going to have some improved accessibility for all screen readers, not just system access. One of the things that has been very difficult is to play catch up with Firefox and changes, of course, in sites like Facebook and stuff like that, because they just seem to happen organically and then everybody has to run back. The new version of Firefox really does go a gangbusters into making things work a little better with screen readers, so I'm excited about that, and we should see that fairly soon as well.
Moving on to Apple news this week, we have an article entitled Everything You Need to Know About the Apple Education Announcement from Gizmodo. Thursday was the day, the 19th, when Apple talked about its new initiative, its new push to revolutionize the way we access textbooks on the iPad, really geared especially for K through 12, but also college texts as well. Steve Jobs wanted Apple to do for education what it has done for music, and it looks like we're moving into that era. There's a new authoring tool for textbooks, for iBooks. $15, $14.95 for some of these textbooks is going to be the price.
As opposed to the $100 that you pay for the paper version.
Dead tree books. Yeah.
Yes.
Paul Theroux has a really interesting article about what is worse, making iPads in China affecting the environment or eating trees left, right, and center for textbooks. Ricky and I have had conversations a little bit offline about this announcement and the ramifications thereof. I think we still need some time to see how this plays out, of course, because with any new announcement and anything like this, you have to see how education takes it or what happens with adoption of any new technology. But Ricky, why don't you go ahead and scale what you're thinking, and then I'll weigh in on mine and we can have a little palaver right here with Jamie.
In this corner. All right. So, by the way, this will be discussed much more in depth on Triple Click Home.
In February.
We recorded January's episode before this announcement, so weren't able to discuss it then. But this, to me, is very interesting for a lot of different reasons. I think that education wants to standardize on something, and we've already seen moves in that direction. There are schools and universities who want to standardize and say, okay, we're buying Kindles for everyone, or we're going to settle on the Nook for students to use. So they're already looking to a standardized platform. It just remains to be seen what that is. For things like online courses and such, Blackboard is currently the standard, and it's universally hated, not only for accessibility reasons, but because it just wasn't designed very well, and it's frustrating for the students and the professors. What Apple's initiative is doing is bringing something to the classroom that is easy, you know, quote, it just works, for the author of a textbook to create. And it's also easy for students to interact with. And best of all, it's accessible. Now, of course, the issue is this hardware is not cheap. The textbooks are, but the hardware isn't.
Right.
Who's going to pay for that? And the textbooks are cheap, but unlike traditional paper textbooks, you're going to be purchasing these every year instead of, you know, every 5 years or whatever. So there's a lot that has to play out, but I feel like this is what the classroom of the future is going to look like. Now, whether Apple remains on top, we don't know, but you can't get away from the idea that tablets are going to take the place of traditional paper textbooks. And this is the first step. I feel like it's going to take education a while to catch up with this. You're going to have some early adopters, but in 3 or 4 years, unless somebody comes along and innovates and does something better than Apple, you're going to see an iPad in every classroom, I think.
I first want to preface my comments by saying, for me, this is not about accessibility. This is not about how it helps the blind. This is not about any of that. I think it goes without being said, this is a win-win for us, because it gives us accessible ebooks, which is awesome, you know, in that respect for what now is going to be high school, not college. So my comments, and I'm about to say before you send in your calls and letters and I reports, my comments are more directed to a general sense of how things work. And that comes from my time in government, and that comes from my time in working with education in government. So with that as my preface, let me approach it from this direction. Apple is about selling hardware. Always will be, always is going to be. So it doesn't matter about iTunes or how many books are sold or whatever. Their job is to sell you the next whatever. And I see this as kind of a lock-in. I would feel more comfortable if Apple left this open so the Nook or Amazon or whatever could hook into this, because we're already seeing some commentary about this being iPad only. And we had this conversation on Twitter with some individuals about this should come to the iPhone. Well, universally, for those who are low vision, for those who have motor control problems, for those who have dyslexia, for those who have other disabilities than blindness, the iPad is a much more desirable platform for this, because sighted people do not want to read on a 3.5-inch screen for long periods of time. They don't see as much text. They can't scan as well. And for us, it's great. That form factor works really, really well. Flicking and picking and rolling your fingers down things on a small device is better than having to go on a 9.7-inch screen. But the upside of this is that it's going to be iPad feature-based. And I'm afraid that continuously we're going to have more and more desire for the next iPad in order to get whatever part of any of this software works. We're already starting to see in the gaming space, people say, look, if you have an iPad 1, don't get this. it doesn't work, or even, you know, iPod Touch, third generation model number, blah, 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 and up works really well. But if you don't have that, then don't go after this. And that's a lot to ask for, whether the schools purchase this or parents purchase this. That's literally like saying, like cell phones, you're going to have to buy one of these things every so often. And there is no subsidy here. With your iPhone, there is a subsidy. When you're getting your $200 iPhone, part of that's being paid for by the cell companies in order to lock you into a two-year contract. This is directly to Apple. That's $500, $499 for a 16 gig. And if each one of these books is 1 or 3 gigs, you're going to take up the 16 really quickly if you're taking a very large course load, or some professor decides you need to have 6 textbooks in order to do the course. So initially, that's my first knee-jerk reaction to this.
Yeah,
and the other side of this, really quickly, I'll let you take a swing at me here in a second. You're still going to have initiatives like EPUB 3, which is an open standard. And, you know, that's the other side of this is that if you allow this ecosystem to dominate, then you might not have things like EPUB changing and adding new features, or DAISY or anything else like that, consortiums, because it will all have to go through the control of Apple. If Apple says you can't do it at that point, then you can't do it. It's a control issue. And so there might be innovation that's stumbled across that can't happen because Apple won't allow it. Okay, now take a swing. Go for it.
Oh, man, where do I start? let me respond to your last point first.
Yeah.
The idea that EPUB and DAISY and these types of things are going to go away, that's just not going to happen right now, because EPUB is used in more places than education. And these standards are still being shaken out. The market is going to dictate what will happen. Just because Apple did this doesn't mean, you know, we haven't even seen the platform yet. People may end up hating it and somebody needs to build something better. Or people may go, you know, this was done right. Apple did this right. I'm going to take this Apple idea and build on it and do something better. So I don't think that ebook standards are going to go away or even be that severely affected, at least initially. The other part of this is the hardware. That's what Apple does. Yes, they want to sell you hardware, but you're going to have to pay the piper in some way, whether it's paying $100 for a paper textbook or whether you're paying for some sort of hardware, be that a Kindle or a Nook, which granted are priced lower, but are subject to the same types of things. They release new models every year or so as well. People that had a Kindle now, oh, look at all these features on the Kindle Fire that I can't get with my Kindle version 3. This is just how the market works. And I don't feel a lot of doom and gloom about this. We are at a very interesting transition point, and people are going to have to get used to purchasing a tablet. You know, we don't know what that tablet is going to be, what everybody's going to standardize on, and note that it's going to be different for education and for consumers. So you're going to have different needs. There's money to be made for everybody. But the idea that, oh no, Apple is selling you hardware and so they're evil, or think about this. Well, yeah, that's what they do.
60 seconds for rebuttal, Mr. Chair. really quickly. Amazon, at least, I can read that on another platform. So whether it be, again, we're getting into accessibility here, whether it be the uncomfortable Kindle on PC or the inaccessible Kindle app on the iPad, the ability that I can read this on more than one place is important. And I think also
but
we have to remember,
those are only ebooks. They're not interactive. You don't have a movie. You don't have
but with EPUB 3, we will.
An interactive.
With EPUB 3, we will. We'll have reflowing text, we'll have video embed, and we'll have all of that moving forward. And Amazon came from the book, you know, field. So if anybody's going to adopt anything that'll make publishers happy, it's
20 seconds.
Thank you. It's going to be Amazon. Thank you. And then, you know, at the end of the day, I am very positive about this because the conversation is happening. So I don't mean to be doom and gloom in that respect. Like I said in my preface, I think this is good. It has to start somewhere. It has to start now. Okay.
I did it. Oh, perfect. You nailed. you nailed 1 minute.
All right.
I'm impressed.
Yay!
The only comment I will make anecdotally, I guess, is that in the special education setting, I am seeing the Kindle Fire and the iPad being used in the same classroom. And I think that's interesting. There are things on both devices that teachers are finding useful for students. And so that, to me, I totally see Joe's point and I absolutely agree with it. But I think that kind of lends some strength to Ricky's comment that the market will dictate and that these companies, none of them are going to lay down and roll over and just let Apple have this market without putting up a good, strong fight. So I think these are some extremely interesting times, and I don't think we know how this is going to shake out, actually, right now.
Right, and we talked about the Apple iTunes LP. You know, there has been formats that you know, get announced, and then, you know, the market decides whether they want to do that or not. I totally agree with that. But there's been other Apple news this week. 5.1 is coming, or at least so we think so, because we've heard rumors about iPad 3 announcements, and along with usual new hardware comes new software. And in the new iOS, there might be Facebook integration?
There might be.
Yeah, and I'm wondering how accessible that's going to be, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, I do know that Apple and Facebook were not necessarily friendly with each other. And I think Apple actually wanted to integrate Facebook far before now, but there were some issues that just couldn't be worked out. And so some of this code is showing up in 5.1 and is actually references to Facebook were in 5.0 as well. So it's not clear whether this is rumors or whether this is just all leftover code, but it certainly makes sense that if Apple has integrated Twitter, that they want to do the same for Facebook as well, assuming that all of the issues can get worked out.
Right. And before you go to the point of, oh, it's in the code, so it has to happen. Well, there's been talk about iChat in iOS for a long time. And people have seen remnants of code in betas for iChat, but that hasn't really shown up yet. So there's always things that they play with or toy around with before they actually, you know, put down to the final build.
Well, on that note, I think it's time to take a quick break. But coming up after the break, your emails and another story about Stephen Hawking right here on the Serotalk podcast.
Hey, Dad, how do you throw a curveball? How do you build a fort? How do refrigerators run? How do fish learn how to swim?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
How high can you jump?
But you don't have to know every answer.
How many phone numbers are there?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
How do cell phones work?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
What's electricity?
They just need you.
What's the moon made of?
For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Some debates are worth having.
Apple!
Android!
No, smooth versus crunchy peanut butter, man.
But we solve the world's biggest problems. On the Serotalk Podcast Network, of course.
Welcome back to Serotalk Podcast 93. As promised, some emails, but first of all, let's play an iReport, and then we have some comments.
Hi, I was just calling to give some feedback on the latest Serospectives podcast. I really like the format. I think going month by month was great to kind of relive the year. Unfortunately, I think it was very biased towards Android at times. At points, I thought I was listening to that Android show. I think the Siri was one of the biggest tech news events of the year. It's really made things a lot more efficient using the calendar, setting reminders. Of course, all that functionality was there before, but it's just much more efficient, and I think that was downplayed. But overall, it was a great show, and I appreciate it. Y'all are still hands down the best podcast for assistive technology news and related events, and I appreciate it. Thanks.
Well, first of all, thank you for the iReport. We really appreciate that. We We actually did talk quite a bit about Apple. We talked about Steve Jobs and the passing of Steve Jobs, the iPhone 4S. That was number three on our list of stories. You know, a lot has been said about Siri, and I'm not really sure what else we could have said much more about Siri in this year in AT. And let's face it, Google dominated the news a lot last year. And sometimes you have to, you know, you got to go with what the stories are. If there was one year, Apple just pretty much bulldozed its way through all of the AT stories and ended up number one. And so that's going to happen from time to time.
And when you have two members of that Android show on the panel, we try to avoid bias as much as possible, but we're also human. At least we're going to stick with that line for the moment. And so bias is going to happen sometimes. But again, we certainly appreciate your feedback. And if you haven't listened to This Year in AT, it is available on the Serotalk website. It's where we explore the top stories of 2011. We were talking about Netflix during the past couple of podcasts, and we have an email from Jamal giving us a couple of tips on how he uses Netflix on iOS. And he says, "Hello, I'm writing to tell you how I use Netflix for iOS and get around the inaccessible issues. First, I download and log into the Netflix app. Then I download an app called FlixMan Queue Manager, which is free, but also has an in-app purchase to get rid of the ads. I install and log in on that app, and I use the search to find movies or TV shows that are available on Instant. Then I double tap the play button and it launches the Netflix app and starts playing the video automatically." Sweet. And he offers to record a demo if we're interested in that. We're always interested in demos and submissions. So if you've got a cool app or something that you would like to share with the listeners, drop us a line at resources@serotalk.com.
Steve Matsura also sent an email in response to Mike Calvo's review of some Bluetooth headsets. And Steve talks about an older Plantronics headset that he really likes and hopes that it never breaks because it's going to be hard to find a replacement. I actually understand that. I have a Plantronics headset mic that I used for a long, long time, and the thing was literally about to fall apart. And I didn't want to get rid of it because I really liked it. So sometimes that older technology, you don't dare part with.
Exactly. Hopefully eBay can help somebody out if they're interested in this, the Plantronics 590 headset.
You can certainly send us an email, resources@serotalk.com. You can send us an iReport on iBlink Radio, or you can call 866-997-2522. We would love to hear from you. On this week's Roundabout segment, is Stephen Hawking's voice music to the ears? As we said in the last podcast, Stephen Hawking is 70 years old, and he continues to use speech synthesis technology from the 80s. There was an event not too long ago, his birthday party, actually, that he was not able to attend because he is not well enough to attend. There's some discussion as to why Stephen Hawking wouldn't use newer technology, and as we speculated last time, it's because he really just wanted to keep the identity, the voice that people recognized him by. But many researchers are finding that speech synthesizers that sound too human really kind of creep people out, and they really don't like that. First of all, I'm not sure that I personally find that to be a problem. I don't have a problem with Alex, even when he breathes, you know, on the Mac. But apparently
a lot of people do have issues with that. And some people, mainly the host of Serotalk Weekly, might have issues with the fact that I'm talking and he's not.
I like Alex. I think he's gotten it more right than most.
Thanks, Ricky. Glad to know I'm appreciated.
A lot of these voices sound almost human. And to me, it's not a creep factor, but it's more jarring when a synth sounds very human, and then it gets a pronunciation wrong, or more often, inflection. It gets that wrong. And then it's very obvious. Oh, that is so not human. I was taken in for a second, but wow, you know, now I'm jerked out of that. So I prefer robotic synths because I know what to expect. They sound robotic, so I'm not expecting something human. And it's not as jarring when they get something wrong. In fact, it's almost expected.
Well, this isn't exclusive to our community. There actually is a term called the Uncanny Valley, and it refers mm-hmm. to computer-generated images for those who are sighted, and that the computer generation can be extremely realistic, but the eyes or the way the mouth moves is still very robotic or frozen. And so it creeps people out when something gets so computer-generated but has some little quirk that makes it look obvious that it was computer-generated.
Did you ever see the computer-generated ideal human face? They did all of these studies about what people found ideal and, you know, the measurements between a person's eyes and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And they generated this thing, and apparently people would look at it and say, it does look stunningly beautiful, except it's really creepy and unnatural.
And that's why movies like Toy Story or Avatar, those are aliens. So we kind of trick the brain into going, okay, well, yeah, that's realistic enough. You know, Jurassic Park, dinosaurs, because no one's ever really seen a dinosaur to hold a comparison to. But whenever they've done things like Beowulf or things like that, then people are just like, that's kind of creepy. I don't know if I like that. And we actually have a conversation about creepy toys on EOL recently about Teddy Ruxpin and other toys like that. And that's kind of a culmination of both the words and the visuals, because Teddy Ruxpin was very creepy, actually.
Yes.
You can hear that over at eolshow.com. Or catch it there on the front page of iBlink.
And you know, some researchers, there's actually a former opera director that is taking opera performances and examining them to find what they're calling the tingle factor. What is it about the human voice that really makes people sit on the edge of their seat? And the idea is to take a computer-generated voice, as Ricky was talking about, a more robotic voice, but yet find the more pleasing elements of the human voice and to try to incorporate that. So I personally think that's quite an interesting undertaking, and I will be interested to see what comes out of that, because I also find the almost human but not quite, not creepy but jarring. That's exactly how I perceive it. So I also prefer, you know, quote, eloquence, unquote, those voices that don't even try to sound human.
Yeah, I think the article put it best when it said maybe a computer will sound better if it accepts that it's a computer, rather than trying to make it sound human. So the idea is to put something comforting in there, this tingle factor or whatever, but still make it very obvious this is a computer voice, not a human voice.
So moving on, Ricky, could I interest you in a Braille burger?
That feels yummy. Yeah.
Mm, yeah. A sesame seed bun with a Braille message on it. That's an interesting concept. A South African restaurant chain, Wimpy, decided to tackle this idea and let its blind customers read words in Braille. The thing that I found so interesting or amusing, actually, about this was that they had to use tweezers and place these Braille dots on the bun. And so it said something really exciting, like 100% pure beef.
Right. You know. It sort of feels neat to have a marketing gimmick directed at the blind population. And a lot of people were saying, I don't care about the Braille bun. The thing better taste good. And yes, that is true. But I just like supporting this because it's such a neat idea. It's a recognition that the blind customers are a market who can be catered to in a very creative way.
Years ago, somebody had done Braille's fortune cookies. And when you said it has to taste good, that's what that reminded me of, was that it was neat because the fortune cookies were a little larger to fit, you know, the Braille paper, but they weren't always the best tasting things. So
again,
the novelty of, oh, dude, it's a fortune cookie in Braille, but I don't need the cookie. Here, you want my cookie? I really don't want the cookie. That's okay.
This is gross.
Yeah, I need – well, you know what? I'm going to set this cookie here on top of my Braille fortune so it doesn't blow away. There we go. I found a use for it. That's good.
Ha-ha. A paperweight.
The thing I appreciated about the article actually was the mention of Braille menus and the fact that some servers will read a menu to a blind person in accordance with the ADA. So there's actually a little bit more benefit to this article even than just the novelty of the idea of Braille hamburger buns, I think.
It's crazy because that means internationally, just like in UK and in certain parts of Europe, there's a little bit more access to things than we do here. That seems like we've got a long way to go still, doggone it.
Well, coming up in our last segment, we have a short audio drama presented by Ricky and Joe entitled Taking It to the Next Level.
I'm really glad you joined me here tonight. I just want you to know the last couple of weeks, it's just been stunning. I've learned so much about you. I feel like I know you so well.
I've been looking forward to this all evening. I feel like we really connect on a deep spiritual level. And I've never felt this way with anybody else before. I mean, we've even had our first argument about ranch and blue cheese. But we got past that. We were able to communicate in a way that I've never done before with anyone else.
Exactly. And you know, I've given you, this key to my apartment and this promise ring. And I really feel like we're growing closer. And I just really can't be happier.
I agree. It's such an indication of trust and closeness. It just couldn't be better.
I think we're ready for the next thing. I really do.
Really?
I do. I think we should share our passwords.
Whoa. I have to go now and
what?
I need to wash my hair and I'm going to be busy for the next I'm leaving now.
Did I say something?
Don't call me.
Okay. All right. So, Jamie, you want to explain the idea behind our little melodrama here?
33% of teens would not have given the answer that Ricky gave. 33% of teenagers consider sharing email and Facebook passwords as a form of intimacy, kind of like, pressure to have sex, you know?
This is really disturbing. I feel like...
Violated?
Yes. I don't know how else to put
that. That was the first term that jumped into my... That was where I kept coming around. We talked about this in our pre-show, a promise ring and a password. You know, it just...
Yeah.
Weird. I don't know about this either because so much we were talking about security and social hacking and authentication. And this is kind of a trust portal of sorts. And, you know, do I feel comfortable with this person having so much, you know, let's just limit it down to Facebook. Let's just say it's a Facebook password, you know, with timeline and everything, that person can see everything I send to everybody, not just personal friends and work relations. Now they can see everything and maybe even alter that and change timeline. Maybe they go back and delete themselves from my timeline and not only change my relationship status from, involved to it's complicated to single. Nope. That's how I found out I was broken up. I logged in one day.
I saw it on Facebook. Yeah.
Weird.
This just feels like such a devaluation of privacy. Like privacy is becoming something that a particular generation doesn't care so much about, and they're willing to share everything. And to me, it's a sign of maturity to be able to understand that there are things that it's okay to keep to yourself. There are things that it's okay to share with one group of people and not others. And to me, you can trust someone implicitly, but that doesn't need to be expressed in this way.
Yeah. Yeah, not everything is an open book. Not everything is meant to be shared, you know?
No, and sometimes you actually can have a more productive and intimate conversation if you share, you know, some story about yourself or whatever with the person directly rather than having them read something in an email that you wrote to somebody else, which was never intended for them. You know, you weren't talking to that person when you wrote the email. So again, there's a lot to be said for just basic human interaction rather than saying, here's all my stuff, go dig through everything, you know, pick through my garbage can and et cetera.
Well, all three of us on this podcast are married and
yeah.
I don't have my wife's Facebook password, nor do I desire
it. I don't want it.
No. No, thank you.
Not just because Facebook isn't really accessible, but I just – it doesn't matter to me. No. It's not something that I feel like I have to be involved with. I mean, we share an email, you know, but that's to me not the same as I need to go sorting through her timeline and find out how long she's been playing, you know, Cafe World. I mean, that's just different to me. And I guess you're right. I guess some of it is generational.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my wife and I have been married 12 years. I don't ask her every time she gets a phone call, who was that? You know, none of my business. If she wants to tell me, she can.
To me, obviously, it's a sign
if the conversation sounds life-changing, I might ask.
But and if she doesn't have a password on her iPhone, and you can just hit voiceover and go look at her call. No, I'm sorry. Wait a minute.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you know a little too much about that.
We're an Android household. Hold on.
Oh, yeah, that's right. But
I have to go
iPads.
Enable voice. I have to go enable TalkBack and maybe download the Pico engine as well. So,
But to me, it's a sign of trust not to have to ask those things, to believe that your partner is going to share the important things with you anyway.
Not an easy conversation to have, but, you know, let us know what you think. You've heard us mention iReport and resources, but, you know, we'd be really interesting to hear what you have to say, not just about the tech stories. That's why we have these stories as well. What do you think about what is privacy, what is intimacy, and what is security? We'd love to hear that. You can also leave us a comment on the blog over at sarotalk.com. And if you do happen to listen to us on iTunes, can you do us a favor and just rate us? You don't necessarily have to write a review, but rating the podcast does help us out a great deal. So if you're in iTunes, head on over and look up any of our SPN shows and give us a rating. We'd appreciate it.
Remember that Joe and I and Derek Lane are going to be at ATIA this coming week, so look for some audio from that conference and much more audio content to come right here on the Sarotalk Podcast Network. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Sarotalk. Visit us at www.sarotalk.com. Send us an email at resources@sarotalk.com or leave a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB. That's 2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us in 2 weeks as we explore all that life and the internet have to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life.